Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Well, good morning, Mike. We are continuing on our deep dive today through Dominion. And we mentioned in a past conversation how all frustration is Dominion thwarted. And so I think we see a lot of signs of Dominion thwarted that maybe we don't recognize today. As you've mentioned, Dominion is a bit more of an older word, so we don't hear that specifically, but we can see the world if we try to take a look at it through the lens of Dominion, and give us a lot of answers for why there is a lot of the frustration, violence today. And I think it does at least connect some dots to begin to process further. So could you talk through Dominion thwarted? Where did that idea come from, that frustration is the result of Dominion thwarted?
Yes, I owe that phrase Dominion thwarted to Dallas Willard. And I had the privilege of knowing Dr. Willard and in a small way and studying under him. So the notion of Dominion is, as we were saying, is as old as Genesis, when God gives Adam and Eve dominion over the earth. And actually, you can chart out the book of Genesis just as, imagine a stone thrown in the middle of a pond, and the ripples that go out, the circles of ripples, you have these 10 ripples, 10 generations of having dominion. But in a fallen world, dominion can go south pretty quickly. And so synonyms for dominion, even though we still hear it a little bit, Virginia is, you have Old Dominion University there. But it would be power, authority, or a softer word would be influence. Control would be another one. So none of these are necessarily pejorative terms, but they can be terms that are be corrupted, or the influence could be corrupted. So what we mean by dominion, first of all, is power, authority, influence. And everyone has been given some measure of influence or power and authority because we're made in the image of God. So, example, regardless of who you are, you have some control over your schedule. You certainly have, even the most extreme instance, what Victor Hugo and others spoke of in imprisonment, Bonhoeffer. You have control over somewhat your emotions, your thoughts. You have a certain measure of responsibility and freedom there. But most of us never end up in a Bonhoeffer concentration camp situation. But we do have, so we have authority or dominion, and we hardly think about it. And frustration is when you assume or presume you have more authority than you actually have. And I got that from Dr. Willard. And that is not just an interesting concept or something to talk about. Actually, if you just open this morning's headlines or the newspaper, you will see what happens when Dominion goes south. In fact, it's fascinating that during this Advent season, one of the passages we read denotes that in God's kingdom, when it is fulfilled, we will no longer, it says, learn war. So war is a learned skill. It predates creation when Lucifer, the brightest, shiniest being ever made, was frustrated. We don't know why. It's none of our business. Ezekiel, Isaiah tell us this happened before the heavens and the earth were created. And we read seven phrases, which is a picture, by the way. Typically, seven denotes some kind of completeness. What you're seeing there is a completely corrupted being saying, I will ascend to the Most High. I will basically become God. I'm going to rule this place. I'm going to. And of course, that's ridiculous. But it sets off a war. A third of the angels join in. Again, if you ask why, good question. We have no idea why. There is such a thing, as we said before, Pat, called forbidden knowledge. It's just things that we don't need to know. We're not omniscient. We're not infinite. If we knew everything God knows, our head would explode. And so we know that that Lucifer lost. He was cast to the earth. So warfare existed on the earth, but it was sealed up. And we opened the Pandora's box. So dominion thwarted. Also, as the ripples go out from a stone thrown in the pond of goodness, the ripples also go out in terms of badness. And the ripples that you see in the Sermon on the Mount, but you also see it elsewhere in Scripture, it begins with frustration. But frustration can grow into anger, which, although not necessarily bad, is generally best avoided. Anger, then, Jesus said, can grow into contempt. Now, what do you think that word means?
Well, I hear it. I hold you in contempt, right? And that's the legal kind of phrasing for that.
Right, which means?
I guess wrongfully arrested type thing?
No.
Interesting.
If I look at you in contempt, why am I looking at you?
There's a certain level of judgment. Anger to me is a synonym there.
Yes, it's harsh. You moron, you idiot.
Mm.
You inferior. It is to be contemptuous is to assume I'm damn well better than you. Who are you to tell me that? Who are you? Now, contempt is why Jesus said calling someone a moron puts you at risk of the lake of fire. Because in the image of God, no one is made as a moron. No one is made that way. And you are not aware of God's image in everyone. Once you're in the realm of contempt, you're one step away from violence. And so if you can't get your way by influencing someone and you get frustrated, then you can't get your way by becoming angry and perhaps yelling at people, bullying people, raising your arm as if you were going to strike them, or the more subtle ways of excluding them or assassinating their character amongst other people or triangulating, and you still don't get your way, you can resort to violence. The violence that is most lethal sometimes is not physical. It can be assassinating someone's reputation. That's fairly violent. In fact, it's interesting that Jesus says the kingdom is constantly being shaken by violence. It's trying to be overthrown by violence. And then again, if you have the sort of power and authority available to you, the levers of power in society, you can turn that violence into actual murder. You might have a gun. There's a lot of ways to murder people. And so these spasms of violence that we see particularly here in the United States, but around the world, our dominion thwarted.
Yeah, it does make me wonder. I mean, there's a lot of analysis going on trying to understand the psychology of violence, and particularly today. And I think those are great, excellent efforts that we should pursue. But it is an interesting lens that you just don't hear about, which is the balance of control and power. And I think it's an interesting lens. What you said about contempt was fascinating. I hadn't thought about the element of superiority that blends in with that, right? I guess the difference between anger and contempt there is a sense.
That's
of,
the, yeah. That's the biggie. That's yeah. The biggie is, and by the way, we feed that sometimes in people who feel a sense of superiority because the old joke is if you're a successful business leader, you don't get a decent review after the age of 35. People just give you deference. The old joke was for one of our past presidents is he hadn't picked up lunch in 20 years. hadn't had to open a door when he walked into just getting into his car. Those things are not benign, and they can give you a sense, especially those who lose them and then suddenly become aware of how inured they are to them, that you are somehow a cut above the rest. And if you're a cut above the rest and then you're unable to persuade those inferior people of your brilliance or your brilliant plan or your brilliant strategy, you can resort to levers of violence or manipulation or coercion. Now, again, we're not going to go down this because it would be a deadly detour, but we've seen that in the last couple of administrations, for example, and we're seeing it in spades right now, just with, for better or worse, richer or poor. We haven't had, in recent memory, really a president who didn't give off an air of superiority. I think you'd have to go back to George Bush, who, although he's mocked, he never gave off an air of being contemptuous. And now we have on both sides of the parties, candidates and presidents, considering other people on the other side of the spectrum, calling them deplorables or clinging to their guns and religion. And then, of course, with the current administration, I don't think it's hard for anyone to imagine if I were to just say, tends to show a great deal of contempt for people that he doesn't agree with. And this is ruinous to a society. So it happens on a macro level. And unfortunately, on a macro level, that plays... it plays an undue or a disproportionate influence on the behaviors of people, just people like you and me, because you might read it and go, damn right, get them, those idiots. And this is why I'm not deep into social media, because social media primarily but not exclusively is people visiting sites that confirm and strengthen their views. They hardly ever read something on the other side. So the whole notion in Proverbs that one side seems right until you hear the other side. But very few people, believers or otherwise, ever hear the other side. So we are becoming a society that more and more is contemptuous. And I've heard my those on the political right, friends of mine, say things, for example, about Mrs. Clinton when she was running. And I just thought, that's crazy. That is contemptuous. She is made in the image of God. You don't have to agree with her, but you also don't have to belittle her. And so we are in a world of contempt is rife throughout the planet, and Jesus talked about this a long time ago. That is, you're seeing these, you throw a stone in the pond, the ripples go out whether you want to or not. And if the ripple starts out with frustration, that frustration, if you want to keep it very local, would be when I first moved here to Annapolis, 1987. And one of the first people I met was a fine, quote, Christian business person. And the toxicity that he described his marriage after a while, within one or two times, I said, what is going on? He said, I haven't had sex with my wife in 10 years. And there was such contempt for her that, so I get it that it started with frustration. And I've done a whole lot of marital counseling, so I know where a lot of frustration starts. It starts with, you know what we're talking about, and one person feeling like, I'm not getting enough, or blah, blah, blah. Different levels of how much they want to enjoy sexual intimacy. Best to deal with that right then and there. And this person hadn't, and 10 years out, it had turned into contempt for this woman. And no surprise, this woman is made in the image of God with intuition, and it's just no way, and you know what, she's now going to sleep with this guy. Yeah. It's crazy. So the ball of yarn really unravels, and it's all built around God gave us dominion that has a moral dimension that the animal kingdom does not have. And so beavers have dominion, not because they're made in the image of God, but because God made them, so they create beaver dams. And that's exercising dominion to create a home. They too reproduce. But God didn't say the animals, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and rule it. Rule it. Whoa, there's dominion. And that's why you don't see beavers gather a whole bunch of beavers around a dam and say, we're damn well going to take those squirrels out. We're going to extend our influence. And then next thing you know, you got a bunch of beavers paddling over to a squirrel, and they surround him and just beat the crap out of him. And they say, there, now we got a little more land.
Make for a great movie.
You got to throw these off into, yeah, no, I hadn't thought about that. Maybe I got the next Watership Down. If you're ever going to break out of some of these really stunted religious ideas we have, you've got to throw them off, like Lewis said, into a fantasy world where you'd go, that's crazy. It is crazy. And now that I think about it, in Narnia, the person who really understands God best initially is Mr. and Mrs. Beaver.
It's interesting. Well, that brings up a good point. I mean, there's a sense of ordered dominion or order control. You know, we see those sort of power structures in the animal kingdom, but they're kind of set. They're not, wolves don't decide to together and come together and democratically elect a leader. It just doesn't happen that way.
And beavers aren't building high rises. Beavers are building dams the way they built dams from the day one.
Yeah. But the unique thing about human beings is we have this ability to overtake dominion. And I think that's an interesting or an important piece to mention about dominion is what we're talking about. Is there is a sense of rightly ordered power. And power itself is not a bad thing. I think you hear voices of that today. Too much power is a bad thing, and we do have the ability to take too much. And so there's that sense of frustration can be that someone has taken too much power and you're frustrated by that, right? That makes sense, and that fits the model of dominion thwarted. But that is a frustration based on incorrect ordered dominion. But there is also the sense that you simply want more than you're supposed to have. You may be the beaver wanting to go take over the squirrel in that regard, right? As a husband, I may want more sex than my wife does, and I'm seeking more dominion in that regard than I should have. And that is an unbalanced equation there. And that is a frustration that as a husband you would be experiencing that isn't your wife's fault necessarily.
Well said. In fact, what you're striking at is then ultimately the issue in scripture is not power and dominion and influence. It's again, the ordering of your loves.
Yeah.
And if you, as the psalmist wrote, and Augustine understood Psalm 37:4 this way, love God, do what you want to do.
Yeah.
Delight yourself in the Lord. So if you 10 to 1, this man whom I haven't seen in years around here, I think his marriage fell apart. You know, his loves were just all screwed up. But you can't really talk about that anymore. Even in the Christian community, very little talk about Augustine's notion that, as he wrote in the Confessions, that my love is my weight. There's the Latin word gravitas. My love is my gravitas. Wherever it goes, I follow. I'm going to gravitate to wherever I love. And so if I love wanting to live somewhere and I can't afford it, my friends can. And I just begin to get really PO'd at them because, or PO to God, because I should have that. You know, the issue isn't any of these things. It's I got screwed up loves, a screwed up order of loves.
Why is it that you think we were created to have dominion and have to sort through that? Why is it that, unlike the animal kingdom, where it's sort of dominion is defined, there's a clear way of things, why is it that us humans, being created in the image of God, we were given this responsibility of rightly ordering dominion? I mean, our loves, obviously, but dominion itself.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I wanted to say something funny like, well, it's because birds are stupid. Think of bird brains.
Are you holding birds in contempt?
I know. Oh, wow. All of a sudden, we got a replay of Hitchcock's movie. I got a bunch of birds gathering on the window out here. Can't wait for you to come out, Mike. I dare you. Well, that's a great way to pivot over to a word that probably has become too common in our vocabulary. So it's like a coin that if you rub it long enough, the face of Washington or Lincoln just disappears. You really can't see it anymore. But it is a quarter. It is a nickel. But the markings are pretty much gone. And that word is discipleship. There are words in, there's language in the Christian community that is so common that we hardly know what it means anymore. And not to suggest that Pat and I are going to discuss, you know, we're going to tell you everything it means. But it is, it pivots on this question that Pat just asked, and it's this, that if the gospel is the Father, Son, Spirit, God, love, and love is the enjoyment of the circle, Father, Son, Spirit, and the desire to expand the circle, then the gospel has always been understood as God, Father, Son, Spirit, the triune God, seeking to wed their joy with other beings. The gospel is God, Son, marrying us. Otherwise, if the gospel is just Jesus came to die for sinners, if that's the good news, then there's no good news in the universe before we fell. And yet, Adam and Eve are created before the fall, and they might have enjoyed a long, long time before the fall. And if the gospel is only Jesus came to die for sinners, then there's no good news before the fall. I think there is good news. The good news is Genesis, the second recounting of creation, God, who is called Elohim, powerful in Genesis 1, is now Yahweh, which means covenant keeping. So it is implicit from the beginning that God is making a covenant. Marriage is a covenant. And so you have Adam and Eve are created. And here's the here's what discipleship, I think, is ultimately about. Think of the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed. We believe in God, Father, maker of heaven and earth, the creator, the maker. Now, we know God is three in one, so Jesus is maker, creator. And he seeks to wed us, to marry us. Adam and Eve are created as adults, by the way. How much experience do they have making, creating? How much dirt do they have under their fingernails? Now we know they begin right away because God, who is love and maker, Adam is introduced to Eve, and the first thing they do is make love. They make more love. So right from the giddy-up, they are getting dirt under their fingernails. They are beginning to appreciate what their husband has always been. So I think discipleship is actually becoming, as Paul wrote to the Corinthians when he said, I betrothed you to Christ, I betrothed you to one husband, to Christ, that I might present you as a pure virgin. So discipleship is really learning to love what our husband loves in the order in which he loves those things. It's learning to work at making the world a better place, the cultural creation mandate, so that we are up to speed when our husband comes. So we are a prepared and pure virgin, as Paul put it. And as Jesus often told in many parables about coming, the groom coming, and wanting a bride who is prepared. Discipleship is preparing for the great wedding feast. We who are already married, betrothed, we're in a period of preparation. That's discipleship.
Yeah, I mean, I think you see that in marriage itself, going back to dominion. If a spouse is trying to incorrectly exercise control, or if a spouse naturally presumes to have more control than they ought, you'll get tension and frustration, and that's not a healthy marriage. Part of that process, speaking from experience, is learning to submit to one another, restoring.
Yes. Peace. Yes, that's a great point, Pat. That this is what I feel anyway is often missing in our notions of discipleship is we don't start with why.
Sure.
We start with how and what. So why takes in this mystery that is the mystery of marriage also is, Pat, in your body, you incarnate or you manifest aspects of Jesus, our husband, and yet, mystically, ultimately, you are his bride.
Right.
You're both and.
Yeah.
And your wife manifests aspects of Jesus' bride, the church. And yet, ultimately, she is not she. She is we. We are the bride. So it's these tensions between God creates Adam and Eve as individuals, and yet He says, let us make them. So we are them, I, simultaneously. We are, I am male, and yet I am female, bride, ultimately. I'm both and at the same time. Now, I'm not in any way suggesting that gender doesn't matter. I think the gender blurring is another topic for another day, but it denotes we've lost this story. The mysticalness of the human race that's not in the animal kingdom is that we are spiritual beings inhabiting a physical body, and this physical body is actually the best telling of the gospel, male, female. And discipleship is the discovery of the depths and heights and breadth of all that, all centered around God is love. Love is that is seeks to, it not only enjoys the circle of love, but seeks to expand it. And that expansion, which includes, and that takes in dominion, would be a whole lot of fun and still a lot of work if we had never fallen. It would just be fun work. But because we fell, it's just a whole lot more difficult.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating if you look at tensions in relationships and you see many, many times dominion being the cause. Someone is expecting more dominion than they've earned, or someone is trying to exercise more. But what's kind of been reshaping my understanding of community and discipleship has been this idea that we are to be one. There is a sense of together as individuals, we are collectively meant to be a bride. And that's really hard to do if you don't get along with other people.
Really?
and that's such a saddening piece to me sometimes, is we overemphasize this individual pursuit of our faith. And we think that as long as I'm reading my Bible and I'm feeling good, then that's fine. But my tensions with family or my tensions with other coworkers or non-believers, that stuff's not really, that's just a negative side effect of being here on earth. Not realizing that I think there really is, there's a learned element to being the bride, and dominion plays a big, big part to that. If we don't understand how to exercise dominion well, we miss a big part of being the bride, which I think emphasizes the importance of dominion when it comes to discipleship, like you said.
Without a doubt. When the disciples ask Jesus, so how do we pray? He said, well, pray this way. This is why 2/3 of the worldwide Christian communion recites the Lord's Prayer. The rest of the worldwide communion ad libs. And ad lib means as you please. So too much of the church, especially in America, prays as they please, versus Jesus told his disciples, pray this way. Our Father, who saturates the heavens, holy is your name. Now get this, the next phrase is actually an imperative. It's actually a command. Imagine this. The creator of the universe says to his created beings, you can command us to do this. You can command Father, Son, Spirit, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. Translated, we want your kingdom to come. We are ordering your will be done. Now, that would be, if we had never fallen, that wouldn't disturb us at all. But because we're fallen, we're going, whoa, that is a recipe for disaster. Yes. So look at how the Lord's Prayer ends. Thy, it is about your kingdom, your power, your glory. The end of the prayer is total yielding to the triune God. And in fact, power, kingdom, glory are the three temptations of Christ by Lucifer, that old bastard who's still roaming the earth. And he knows how this works. And if you can just get Jesus to exercise more dominion. So discipleship, yes, you're exactly right, Pat, is every problem that I probably have ever had is by trying to exercise more dominion than I had. And I do a fair amount of coaching, and this week I was with, we were talking about a situation in the office where this person works, and a great deal of frustration with a colleague, but this is a person who has been going through a rigorous discipleship for the last several years. So I was able to ask this person, how much dominion do you have left anymore with this person? And this colleague that I'm working with correctly said, probably about 1%. And at that point, this person knew, that's where I've been screwing up. I always have a mental picture in my mind that when I'm talking to anyone, there's a bead of 100 pearls between us, extended straight in a line right between us. And some of those pearls are mine, I have dominion, and some are the other person's. But if you don't ascertain which ones are mine, which ones represent what I have, the dominion I have in this, rightly so, because everybody, God has given us, he wants us to have dominion. But this individual was frustrated because this individual had forgotten, I have next to no authority. And so every time this individual wanted to either set the colleague straight or teach them something they felt that had been forgotten or to remind them of protocols, all they were doing is just putting more grit and gravel in that person's shoes, just irritating the heck out of them. And this individual understands that practicing some of these spiritual disciplines of silence and solitude, some of the things we read in Ignatian spirituality, is simply find a better way to resolve these things, which in their case involves having another partner in the company actually serve as counselor, because this individual has forfeited through some actions in the past practically all their dominion. So my friend who I met here in 1987 probably had forfeited whatever dominion he might have had with his wife through his seething anger, resentment, forcefulness, he's very intelligent, so he probably did what I call verbally surround people. I've known people in the past to do that. Your intuitions tell you, this guy's full of, you know what? And you just begin to ask some questions. The next thing you know, you're surrounded by their language. They've just completely surrounded you. And you go, I've come away from those times feeling like, well, I thought I saw something, you know, so maybe I'm just the one who's wrong. And if you have that happen over and over and over, so after a couple of years, you're not going to be very drawn to that person because you're going to feel like, and when I'm around that person, I am ignorant. And in fact, there was issues of control for that other person, controlling the conversation. That wasn't as ignorant. Because I'm not, more often than not, I'm not nearly as smart as I think I am. So that's a whole nother issue. But I'm not, you know, there's a whole lot of intuitive people. They're not as ignorant as they are, think that as they've been made to feel. And it's because some people are extraordinarily good at not feeling frustration by verbally discounting you. So you come away feeling like, yeah, okay, yeah, maybe I've just been an idiot. I can swear that guy's arrogant. But so this whole thing on dominion, by the way, and discipleship, I don't know what made me think of it, Pat, but yeah, I'm a boomer. And I have, one of the things, you've been in this quote business long enough is, so I know of at least four or five ministries where the ministry heads, when they passed away, were not on speaking terms with other ministry heads. And it had been born out of turf and disagreements, you know, turf, like, hey, you're on my turf. And I think of, you know, all these ministries talked about discipleship. And yet I know for a fact, I won't name the names, but they died and they weren't on speaking terms with one another. What kind of discipleship is that? And you have such a lack of collaboration in so many ministries. And quite frankly, it was this, I can't remember who did it, but the survey, if people were really honest, they said their greatest fear was a fear of exposing their donor base to a potentially superior model. So wow. And so, you know, that's dominion. That's corrupted dominion, frankly. And I remember why I'm thinking of this, because you rightly noted, you know, Jesus' prayer is that we'd all be one. The reason he's all be one is he wants a bride who doesn't talk out of both sides of her mouth. He wants one voice. And I'm quoting now Romans, where Paul talks about this. And the point is that we would want with one voice glorify God. One voice. It'd be difficult to be married to Kathy if she had five different stories about what she did yesterday. I wouldn't know who she was.
Yeah.
So this notion of one voice, it gets back to why discipleship? To be what Paul talks about, 2 Corinthians 11:2, a pure bride, a prepared bride. Frankly, as it's described in Psalm 42, a panting bride. As the deer pants for the water brook, so my soul pants for thee. I remember doing premarital counseling years ago, and this, again, this is just the way normal people talk. And young woman said, because they were being chased, and she said, I can't wait for the wedding night. I am so jacked up. And which I'm sure her fiance was like, yes. Guess what? They were imaging God. Jesus was looking for a bride saying, I can't wait for the wedding feast described in Revelation 19, 20, 21, the consummation, the wedding bed. Yes, I can't wait. Jesus going, yeah, that's who I want to marry. That's who I want to consummate with. I don't want to come with all my friends and have our lanterns lit coming into the great procession into town and the entourage of the bridesmaids waking up the bride and saying, wake up, he's here. I don't have any oil in my lamp. That's why discipleship.
Well said. Well said. So, granted, I'm sure, excuse me, many, many listening to this probably haven't heard dominion or at least understood it in the context of discipleship. That was very unveiling for me. What's a way that I can... obviously, in the discipleship model, I want to be discipled by someone. But there is, an extent to which there may not be someone in my life right now that even understands dominion and is able to disciple me there. And so yes, from a discipleship perspective, I definitely advocate that sense of mentorship. But as a single individual, what are some of the ways that I can be more mindful of gaps in dominion in my life that possibly I therefore need to kind of correct and reorder myself?
Boy, that's a great question. You know, the old adage is you can't take someone further than you've been. So part of the challenge and what we're talking about here, Pat, is how few mentors seem to be available today. Mentors, you know, is the old Greek story. The father entrusts his son to mentor for this journey because the father knows that mentor has walked this path already many times. Mentor knows the way. And so having said that, I have an idea, but I'm first going to commend you. Fascinating how you just described that part of today has been an unveiling. That's a fascinating way to describe it. What does that remind you of?
Christ on the cross, the veil being torn.
Close. The veil being torn, let's come back to that in a moment. This will wake our listeners up. They'll go, say what? Paul said, all of us. Yes, there you go. See, when is the bride unveiled?
At the wedding ceremony.
That's right. And so it is an unveiling. It is preparing for an unveiling. So all of us are veiled. The curtain being torn is understood in a lot of traditions as similar to the tearing of the hymen. So it is, again, a depiction of marriage. And so we could go into that in another time, but you have all of these depictions, all of them based in the picture of the gospel is Jesus marrying us. It is Father, Son, Spirit wedding their joy. And so, yes, all of us want to be with faces unveiled. Faces unveiled. I don't know if your wife had a veil when you came down the aisle. I'm assuming he came down the aisle. I'm making a lot of assumptions here. But I know, you know, my wife, Kathy, did. And then at a certain point, we lift the veil. And then we kiss. So today's wedding ceremonies are not an exact representation. I do know a friend of mine, a Ghanaian, as he's discovering this, is also feeling an unveiling that his wedding actually was closer to what's depicted in scripture. They had a pronouncement ceremony. Then they had but they didn't consummate after that. They had a period of preparation. Then they had another ceremony. Then they had consummation. That's the gospel right there. So you are married, Pat. You have been betrothed to Christ, married. Again, if someone goes, no, betrothal is engagement. I heard someone the other day say that, and I said, really? Mary was betrothed to Joseph, and Joseph is called the husband of Mary. He went, ah. I said, engagement is a Western notion. That's not a biblical notion. And who knows, if we didn't have engagements, we'd do better at understanding nuptial union, because engagement often turns out to be doing every last blasted thing I can do short of intercourse. It's just, it's crazy. It's a crazy maker. That's been our experience anyway. And that maybe we're different, but I don't think so. So it's an unveiling. You said you hit the nail on the head. And so what does that mean? Well, we started here with Dallas Willard, and perhaps we will close with this podcast with Dallas Willard. Now, let me tell you a story, and I'm going to tell it to you carefully because this can be understood rightly one way and misunderstood 10,000 ways. Hmm. So in 1995, I had felt called of the Lord to step away from the pastorate. There was no sin. I had a series of lunches and the final one in Columbia, Maryland, a man I'd never met before, had a word from the Lord. And it was the same word that others had told me in a series of luncheons. And it was like the Lord was saying, listen to him. And I did. Came home, told my wife that I was resigning. This is funny, only in retrospect. We had three young kids, busy, busy house. And I walk in and I say, hey, hon, how was your day? Fine. How was yours, Mike? Fine. Kathy, I got to talk to you. I'm going to resign. And she goes, that's fine. Can you help me set the table? So I walked over, as best as I recall, I walked over and took her gently by the shoulders so that we were facing one another. And I said, no, I'm quitting. And, needless to say, that was not a joyous dinner. But, you know, the remarkable, remarkable woman she has become through, there might have been better ways for me to do it, but the fact of the matter, my wife has blossomed as a woman who loves God and is vivacious and all of that stuff. I mean, she would say, looking back, probably shook some of her settled assumptions on how life was going to work out. But a week later, after I resigned, I was in a course up in Chicago for a week under Dallas Willard. And Pat, I must tell you that, first of all, it was a doctoral course. I paid paid the bucks for it and what have you. I remember there was, I think, 40 in the class. And Dr. Willard simply talked to us like we're doing right now. And about the second day, there was a man who was sitting right in front of him, probably my age. I was 41. Boy, he would take out after Dr. Willard here and there with various comments. Like, oh, what do you mean by that? Blah, blah, blah. And I'm just kind of watching this. And by about the third day, I'm also watching that all sorts of other students are sneaking in the back of the class and sitting there. And I'm going, you guys haven't paid for this class. There was something magnetic. But on the Wednesday, this guy sitting right in front of Dr. Weather just begins to lace into him. And then he just stops and he begins to tremble. And he begins to cry. And he just said, I'm sorry, Dr. Royal, I'm just all effed up. Yes, he used the F word. And he just began to pour out his heart about what a mess he was. And the Dr. Willard came over and just put his hands on him. We gathered around that guy and prayed. But I'm gathered around saying, that guy's me. I'm messed up. And after that course, I began to recite the Lord's Prayer every day because he walked us through the Lord's Prayer. It was actually preparation for his book, The Divine Conspiracy. So if you're listening to this podcast and a lot of this is unfamiliar to you, you could begin by reading The Divine Conspiracy by Dallas Willard. But here's the other thing that makes it difficult and gives me an idea, Pat, that I think you and I are working on. I think it was about Thursday. There were three of us in the course, and we went up to Dallas during a break and said, hey, can we take you to lunch? And he said, yeah, sure. By the way, he'd just spoken on fasting. So I think when we sat down at this, you know, I don't know where it was, Fridays or wherever it was, you know, we were all very cognizant of can't order too much food here. And he orders this whopping cheeseburger. And so we were having blah, 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 whatever we were talking about. And my friend Tom said, so Dr. Willard, what do you make of the Western church, the church in America? And Willard was about to take a bite out of his burger, and all he did was he said this, it's a lost cause. And then he just took a big bite out of his burger and just sat there eating. And that's exactly how the three of us at that table.
Oh, my.
We didn't know OMG back then. We didn't text. We didn't. Yeah, you could. Good thing it was a busy restaurant because you could have heard a pin drop. As best as I can recall, no one followed up with him on that statement. But I was thinking, this is someone I want to follow, because first of all, this is a doctoral course at a seminary, so he hasn't given up on the church. What he felt was a lost cause was Western Christianity that sprung out of the Enlightenment. And this is a whole 500-year development that few of, I understand, listeners are going to be familiar with. It's no fault of theirs. But frankly, Pat, dominion and discipleship, most everything else, we have framed up in the wrong frame. We've lost why. And Dr. Willard seriously doubted it could be recovered in his lifetime. So he gave himself to trying to mentor as many possible future mentors as possible. And that's what I think you and I are trying to do, is you might be listening to this podcast and you're in Munich or Mumbai or Minneapolis. But my hunch is, if you resonate with this, you're one of the diaspora, modern day diaspora. Diaspora, dispersed. Dispersed all around the planet, with an intuitive sense that you love God, but the why, the mystery, the magic of the gospel somehow has just been, it's just been drained out of this thing. And Dr. Willard was instrumental. And so where do you start? You got to find conversations that are going on like this. You got to find some way to latch onto them, begin to build networks, read The Divine Conspiracy. I frankly would point people also to some of the work of Christopher West on why we have a physical body and how the physical body best tells the gospel, especially our sexuality as male and female. I think it will astound you to hear stories from epochs past in the church that sound Yiddish today in our Western ears. Kind of a say, what? But I often joke, we'll get to heaven, which I really don't know how this thing unfolds when you think about, you got ministry leaders who never spoke to one another in the last 20 years of their life, and they arrive in heaven. How does that work? But I think also we'll be sitting with maybe meet Abelard, and we'll tell him how we worked out the faith, and he'll go, say what? Do you guys believe in Jesus? Yeah, of course. He goes, and that's how you saw it? course, we'll have perfected natures then. So we'll go, yeah, yeah, we were idiots. And, you know, he won't be wagging a finger, but oh my stars, there's just, there's so much to be said here that I just think, Pat, I don't think there is a simple solution. Let's close with this point. When Copernicus, the day he passed away is the day he submitted his book to the Pope, humbly suggesting that the entire frame for the universe was incorrect. Ptolemy's frame was wrong. The words were right: star, moon, suns, planets. The arrangement was entirely wrong. The earth is not at the center of the universe. The sun is. He was right. He wasn't original in that. Others have been saying that. But the fact of the matter is, all those voices were dispersed. They were the diaspora. Where could they go? This wasn't taught in any of the major universities. This wasn't in any of the books. It took a number of years before the Western world shifted to the Copernican system. That's what Thomas Kuhn wrote about when he introduced the phrase paradigm shift. It took at least 20 years. Some would say it took 100 years. And during that switch, there were a lot of very lonely people who said, man, I tell you what, everything I see and read from Copernicus, it just makes sense. But when I go to church, they think I'm talking Yiddish.